In August 1983, two young German tourists, 27-year-old Bernd Gorick and 22-year-old Andrea Scherp, went on a hiking trip in the Kootenays. During this trip, they were shot and killed on a remote trail. Their passports, money, and traveler's checks had been stolen. The only piece of physical evidence was a pair of 34-size waist blue jeans that were covered in blood about a few kilometers from the bodies. After 6 years, the case went cold. In 1989, a drug dealer, who was also a police confidential informant, told detectives about a woman who claimed she knew who committed the murders. This led police to Madonna Kelly. She told police that her friend Andrew Rose showed up at her trailer the night of the murders in 1983 and was covered in blood. He had blood all over his face and clothes. She said Andrew Rose told her about killing the tourists. Police wired Rose's phone and asked Madonna to call Rose, but he did not confess. The testing of blood at the time was unable to link Rose to the jeans. The traveler's checks were cashed by two men. Neither of them matched Rose's description. The main piece of evidence against him was the testimony of Madonna Kelly. In 1991, Andrew Rose was convicted of two counts of second-degree murder. Rose appealed the case. His conviction was overturned, and he was granted a new trial. Rose had a second trial. Again, Madonna Kelly was the star witness in the second trial. This trial also ended in a conviction. Andrew Rose's second conviction was overturned in 1998 and a new trial ordered. This made police even more determined to get Rose put away for the murders. The RCMP decided to target Rose for a controversial investigative technique known as a Mr. Big Sting operation. Welcome. My name is Lydia Riva. I'm a criminal defense lawyer practicing in Toronto and the Greater Toronto area. In this episode, we will discuss the undercover police investigation technique known as the Mr. Big operation. Criminal defense lawyer Jennifer Budgell will join me to discuss the history of the Mr. Big sting, the law on the admissibility of statements from the Mr. Big, and the danger of false confession from this investigative technique. This is For the Accused. Andrew Rose was released from prison after his second successful appeal. He had no work history. When a man offered him a cash job running errands for him, Rose jumped at it. The man who hired him was a supposed gang member, but was really an undercover detective that was running a Mr. Big operation on Rose to attempt to elicit a confession. Over the next few months, the undercover officer involved Rose in a series of criminal activities, mainly to do with drug trafficking. The undercover officer told Rose that he could stand to profit a lot from the organization, but that he would have to meet with Mr. Big to discuss some troubling issues in his past that could jeopardize the organization. Andrew Rose and an undercover detective attended a bar where they spent about 2 hours drinking beer. After they returned upstairs to the hotel room, another undercover officer had been waiting for them. The officer was playing the role of Mr. Big. Andrew Rose took a seat in the room across from the undercover officers. Rose appeared quite intoxicated by this time and seemed to be very shaky. When questioned about the murder, he said, "Well, we'll go with it, okay? Maybe I blacked out, you know." Rose attempted to give details about the murder, but he did not know those details. He provided wrong guesses about the evidence during his confession. Further testing on the bloody jeans found near the crime site came back, showing the DNA of at least five different people. The only confirmed matches were of Gorick and Scherp. A third person's DNA was prominent, but it did not match Andrew Rose. The Crown ultimately stayed the charges against Rose. A Mr. Big Sting is a covert investigation procedure used by undercover police officers to attempt to elicit confessions from suspects in cold cases. Usually these are murder cases. Police officers create a fictitious criminal organization and then persuade the murder suspect to join the gang. They build a close relationship with the suspect. They gain their confidence and trust, and then recruit the suspect's help in a series of criminal acts for which the suspect is paid. Once the suspect has become enmeshed in the criminal organization, the suspect is persuaded to provide information about their criminal history, usually as a condition for being accepted as a member of the organization. The suspect is introduced to Mr. Big, the fictitious crime organization's kingpin, who is actually a police officer and an interrogator. According to the RCMP website, the RCMP has used the Mr. Big technique more than 350 times across the country as of 2008. The media and others have reported the cost of Mr. Big in some operations. However, there is no consistency in what is included in the costs. For example, in an article in the White Horse Star written in 2007, it was reported that the four-month Mr. Big investigation in the Nelson Hart case cost $413,000. In another case, it was reported that RCMP officers spent $1.6 million in an operation against Wade Skiffington, as reported in the 2009 book, When Justice's Game, Unraveling Wrongful Convictions in Canada. Authors Corey Keenan and Joan Brockman write in their book Mr. Big, Exposing Undercover Investigations in Canada, that they made an access to information request, but RCMP was unable to provide them with the costs associated with the Mr. Big operation. Unlike in Canada, Mr. Big operations, while found to be legal, have not been embraced by police in the United States and the United Kingdom. In Australia and New Zealand, the Mr. Big has been authorized by the courts and embraced by police. As demonstrated in the Andrew Rose case and in other infamous Canadian cases, the Mr. Big operation may lead to a false confession and contribute to the very real phenomenon of wrongful conviction. To discuss this controversial investigative technique, I am joined today by Jennifer Budgell. Jennifer has been a criminal defense lawyer for 20 years. She studied law at McGill University in Montreal and completed her articles at the prominent defense firm of Pinkovsky Lockyer in Toronto. She was called to the bar in 2002. In 2005, Jennifer opened her own criminal law practice in Toronto. Over the years, she has defended hundreds of clients charged with offenses including firearm and drug offenses, fraud, sexual assault, and homicide. In 2016, Jennifer was called to the bar of the Yukon Territory. Since then, she has been practicing in both jurisdictions. Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you joining us from today?
I am in Whitehorse, Yukon.
How long have you had your office in the Yukon?
I've had my office here for about 3 years now. I came to Whitehorse in early 2020 to do a homicide case. And when the pandemic hit, I decided to stay. So I've been back and forth between the Yukon and Ontario. Over the past 3 years, I still do cases in both jurisdictions, but I am based in Whitehorse now.
And how do you like practicing in the Yukon?
I really enjoy it. At first, I wondered if my cases here would be different because it's a population of about 40,000 people in the territory compared with, of course, my working in the GTA where, the population is much larger. I wondered about the cases, but in the end, I find that my cases are, for the most part, very similar.
We're going to be talking about Mr. Big sting operations today. Those operations are generally done in the case of murders. You and I have worked on several murder cases together, both in the courtroom and behind the scenes. And you have worked on murder cases both in Ontario and in the Yukon Territory. So I wanted to start by asking you, how do murder investigations differ from other police investigations?
Well, I think the main thing is that the police put more time and resources into investigating murder cases. Brown put a lot more of their resources into prosecuting them. So you are up against a Crown's office and a police force who are putting their all into bringing the prosecution to court. The defense is always out-resourced on these cases, but the cases, of course, still require as much time and effort on our part, even though we're out-resourced, because when a client is facing a life sentence, their life is truly on the line. So we've got to try to match the time and effort that the Crown and the police are putting into these cases, even though we are out-resourced on these matters.
Earlier in the podcast, I talked about how there is little transparency in the cost of Mr. Big operations. Do you think Mr. Big operations are generally very expensive? How do they differ in cost from murder investigations?
Well, I think, and there's been literature on this, that Mr. Big operations, because they go on for so long, months, sometimes a year or more, because the police are engaging in what are called scenarios where they're meeting with the target of the operation, a vast amount of resources, police resources, are put into these operations. In some cases, they even involve, you know, the police taking the target on trip across Canada to engage in these fictitious crimes or scenarios. So they really take up a vast amount of police resources. I think that's a hallmark of Mr. Big cases across Canada.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of the Mr. Big operation. According to Corey Keenan and Joan Brockman in their book, Mr. Big: Exposing Undercover Investigations in Canada, an RCMP sergeant, Al Haslett, in 2004, in Kelowna, said, "I was probably the one who started it. I was just thinking outside the box, trying to see how far we could go." And indeed, I believe the Mr. Big operation is sometimes referred to as the Canadian technique. So I wanted to ask you, Jennifer, was the Mr. Big invented in the 1990s, as Al Haslett said it was?
We often think of these operations as dating or having been invented in the 1990s, along with the term Mr. Big, but the technique itself actually dates back more than a century to 1901. There's a case called Odd that came out of the Manitoba Court of Appeal, and the police used this technique in that case on the target, Mr. Todd, who was being investigated for a murder.
And what happened in Todd?
So in Todd, a man named John Gordon had been found dead of a gunshot wound in a Winnipeg street. And the police suspected that the accused, Donald Todd, had committed the murder. So it was a little interesting what happened in that case. The police force actually employed two men to act as detectives. They weren't employed as regular police officers, but these men were employed. They acted as detectives, and they posed as criminals who were members of a gang. The two undercover detectives offered to make Todd a member if he would satisfy them that he had committed a serious crime. He had to satisfy them of this in order to get into the gang. And of course, as we see in Mr. Big operations today, they told him, or he was led to believe, that large profits were likely to result for him if he became a member of their gang. So in the end, based on the representations of these undercover officers, Mr. Todd confessed.
In this case, Jennifer, over a century ago, did the judge allow the confession?
The confession was allowed at trial, and when it got to the Manitoba Court of Appeal, the court found that the detective who received the confession was not a person in authority, and even if he was a person in authority, Mr. Todd did not know and could not have suspected that he was a person in authority. So therefore, the confession to the undercover officers was found to be voluntary. The Court of Appeal also found that there was no inducement because Mr. Todd had not been charged with anything at that point. He apparently did not even know that he was a suspect. So the Court of Appeal essentially found that, well, there could not have been an inducement because he was not even aware that he was being investigated for this homicide at the time. The so-called Mr. Big technique was not really part of the appeal in the sense that the court wasn't examining whether the technique was proper or not. But, and this is a really interesting part of the decision, one of the judges, Justice Dubuc, said, and I'm quoting, "The means employed in this case to obtain the confession were contemptible, but it does not seem to be a sufficient ground for excluding the evidence." So there was criticism of the method that the police used to obtain the confession, but the judge went on to compare it to situations where the police used trickery or other forms of artifice to get the accused to confess or to extract a confession from the accused.
Jennifer, what role does Mr. Big play in wrongful convictions?
Well, generally, we see the Mr. Big technique being used where police have a weak case. They do not have enough evidence to lay a charge against the accused. They are dumped to a certain extent. I mean, that makes sense because police wouldn't need to rely on this technique at all if they had the evidence to lay a charge against the accused. We also see the technique being used against vulnerable accused. This happens more often than not. Often the targets of Mr. Big investigations have substance abuse issues. There have been cases where the undercover officers actually feed the accused habit, either by making alcohol or drugs available or paying the accused handsomely for engaging in their scenarios or their criminal activity so that the accused actually earns money to feed their habit. We also see it being used against targets who are socially isolated. So individuals who are estranged from their family and friends, unemployed, maybe down on their luck. And these types of people are very susceptible to new people who suddenly enter their lives and pose as threats.
Given that Mr. Big operations tend to target vulnerable people, could this also contribute to the phenomenon of false confession?
Definitely, because the big question with these operations is whether the target confessed because he or she is actually guilty of the crime, or whether the person was just desperate to be a member of the criminal organization and did not want to lose these new friends who were offering them money, travel, kinship in an organization. So the specter of false confessions is there, I would say, in each and every Mr. Big case.
Historically, there was a shroud of secrecy around these investigations. But now the media has been reporting on these investigations and there's a lot more information out there about Mr. Big stings. Will this make Mr. Big operations less effective?
I hope so. The more information that is out there in the public domain about these investigations, the better. However, at the same time, truly vulnerable people who tend to be the targets of these investigations might not have access to that information in the way that you and I would, or in the way that most, you know, lay people, non-lawyers would, simply by reading the newspaper. So the fear is that it's not information about these investigations is not going to get to the people who truly need to have the information.
Are statements from Mr. Big operations admissible in Canada?
They are, although Mr. Big statements or confessions are considered presumptively inadmissible now after a decision of the Supreme Court of Canada released in 2014 called R versus Hart.
What is the criteria for admissibility?
So in Hart, the Supreme Court of Canada set out a two-pronged approach. So first, as I said, statements made by an accused during a Mr. Big operation are presumptively admissible. And that presumption can be overcome if the Crown establishes on a balance of probabilities that the probative value of the confession outweighs its prejudicial effect. Now, looking at the probative value, what does that mean? Well, the court has to look at the reliability of the confession, and that involves examining the circumstances under which the confession was made. So the trial judge will have to look at the length of the Mr. Big operation, the number of interactions between the police and the accused, the nature of the relationship between the undercover officers and the accused, and importantly, the nature and extent of any inducement offered to the accused. Obviously, the presence of threats toward the accused is going to be important, and also the personality of the accused, including the person's age, their level of sophistication, and any mental health issues that they might have. So what the court has to look at is whether and to what extent the reliability of the confession has been called into doubt by the circumstances in which it was made. And after looking at that, the court then has to look at the confession itself for markers of reliability. So this includes looking at the level of detail of the confession, whether that confession leads the police to the discovery of additional evidence, whether the accused referred to details of the crime that have not been made public, or whether the confession describes details of the crime that the accused person would not know if they had not committed it. If there is separate evidence to confirm the reliability of the confession, this can provide a powerful guarantee of reliability, but it is not strictly necessary. Now, of course, the trial judge will have to weigh this against the prejudicial effect of admitting a Mr. Big confession, because, of course, there's the risk that the jury is going to be prejudiced against the accused because the accused chose to join a criminal organization and was willing to commit crimes at the organization's behest. The judge will also have to look at whether the jury engages or could engage in what is called reasoning prejudice. So if they focus too much on the Mr. Big investigation to the point that they're actually distracted from the issues or the charges that are before the court. Now, in Hart, the Supreme Court put in a second prong. So it's a two-prong test. The first prong I've just gone over. The second prong looks at the doctrine of abusive process. The trial judge has to be alert to the fact that Mr. Big operations can become abusive. And the court was a bit vague on determining what the threshold is for deciding when a Mr. Big operation is abusive. But they said that in conducting an operation, the police cannot be permitted to overcome the will of the accused and coerce a confession. And if they do, this would almost certainly amount to an abusive process.
Jennifer, given some of the problems we've identified with Mr. Biggs, should police be required to get judicial authorization for a Mr. Big operation?
Well, on the one hand, I think yes, that would at least put some parameters on the investigation and would include some judicial oversight. But I actually think it's simply unworkable to require warrants. First of all, it's really hard to define the scope of a warrant for a Mr. Big operation. These investigations are dynamic. They change every day based on the responsiveness of the target. It would be really hard to place parameters on an investigation like this. And additionally, I mean, we see wrongful convictions with respect to regular confessions outside of the Mr. Big context. People falsely confess all the time. And so placing a warrant requirement on a Mr. Big operation would not solve the inherent problems.
Given that, should Mr. Big operations be banned altogether?
Well, I think so. Because no matter how you look at it, there is always an inducement to confess. That's how these operations are structured. The target becomes more and more enmeshed in the supposed criminal organization. So the problem I see is that there is almost always an element of abuse in these operations. We almost always see cases involving vulnerable accused, as we talked about, where the person confesses out of fear, hope of making big money, or sheer desperation. The other issue is that these operations encourage tunnel vision on the part of the police, and that's something that we really don't want in our criminal justice system. The police focus on one person to the exclusion of everybody else. And when the police start engaging in a Mr. Big operation, what other evidence are they failing to see? This sort of tunnel vision approach encourages them to focus on the individual to the exclusion of any other target. And so I'd like to see police actually put their resources into continuing an investigation that is weak through traditional evidence gathering techniques, which might lead them to other suspects rather than engaging in these kinds of investigations, which we know can quickly turn abusive.
Jennifer, on your point that Mr. Big operations contribute to tunnel vision, I would think also the fact that police spend so much time and resources in a Mr. Big operation, it would only enhance their confirmation bias because they wouldn't want to admit to themselves that they are in fact investigating and putting all this time and money into the wrong person.
That's exactly it. They become even more sure that they have the right person.
Jennifer, before you go, I want to ask you one last question. What is something about the criminal justice system that surprised you when you first started working in criminal law 20 years ago?
The thing that surprised me the most is unfortunately something that we still deal with today. The defense is simply out-resourced by the Crown. It's not like law shows on television where the players seem to be on an equal footing. Sometimes on TV, the defense actually seems to have more resources than the prosecution does. We're out-resourced, and that has been an ongoing issue. We can't afford to get private investigators on board necessarily. We can't afford to get the experts that we might need that you see in a television show. And that's an uphill battle when you're facing, as an accused person, a sentence which could involve a jail sentence and could involve a life sentence. It's a real problem.
Thank you, Jennifer, for joining us today and providing us with such good information about Mr. Big operations and your insights into the criminal justice system.
Thank you for having me, Lydia.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe to my podcast. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. That will help people find our podcast. This is For the Accused.